cultural conflict, and American education, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with David Bromwich of Yale University and Gerald Graff of the University of Chicago. David Bromwich is here to talk about his new book, Politics by Other Means. Before that, Gerald Graff discusses his new book, Beyond the Culture Wars.
At a moment when many in our society are questioning traditional assumptions about romantic love, heterosexuality, the nuclear family, abortion, aging, free speech, and the American flag, we should not be too outraged that decisions about which book to assign no longer go without saying.
Literary critic Gerald Graff. In just a moment, he'll be here to talk about his new book, Beyond the Culture Wars. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. The old joke is that academic politics is so poisonous because the stakes are so low. But according to Gerald Graff, a professor of English and education at the University of Chicago, that's no longer the case. Graff notes that universities today are battlegrounds of competing ideologies, where corporate managers work side by side with third world Marxists, Mandarin classical scholars with postmodern performance artists, and football coaches with deconstructive feminists. Gerald Graff's new book is Beyond the Culture Wars. He argues that rather than sidestepping cultural conflicts, professors should teach them to their students, thereby revitalizing American education. A case in point is the problem of teaching the story of Christopher Columbus, to some a hero, to others an imperialist. Here's Gerald Graff.
The critics of education have presented a kind of cartoon of what's happening, so that trends like multiculturalism have tended to be reduced by the critics to their dumbest form, the view that blacks should only study black people, women should only study women, and so forth. You can find people who will take that view, but I think that they are fewer and fewer, and they don't represent, they are not typical, it seems to me, of what's going on in university.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's come to your argument about teaching the conflicts. Rather than polarizing people and intellectual ideological positions, you're saying that we need to look at the conflicts themselves. To what end?
Again, to the end of giving students a better sense of what the issues are and what's at stake in their education than they've been getting. It seems to me that by contrast with a generation ago, students are today being exposed to a much wider and in some ways a more a mind-boggling diversity and disparity of viewpoints, methods, subjects, and so forth. There's been a kind of culture explosion over the last generation, which is tremendously, and it's part of the general democratization of American education. Consequently, students are being exposed, I think, to far more explosive kinds of conflicts and contradictions, which I think they're not getting enough help from us in sorting these out. A student today can go from one course in which it's taken for granted and therefore probably not even stated that, the traditional Columbus story is a kind of ideological myth that's been foisted on us and that we should be highly critical of. The student will go from that course to another course maybe in the next hour in which it is taken for granted and therefore, again, probably not even stated that the Columbus story as traditionally told is valid and as valid as ever and that and ought to be viewed with admiration and veneration. And I think these are mind-boggling contradictions that students need to see engaged and discussed.
Jerry Graff, what do you mean by the term course fetish? And in your book, Beyond the Culture Wars, you also use the expression the myth of the great teacher. What does that have to do with all these struggles?
Well, it has to do primarily with my concern about the incoherence of education. And this is the one respect in which I think the traditionalist critics of education have been right, that the modern curriculum is tremendously incoherent, tremendously disordered. It seems to me that in many ways we really don't have a curriculum. What we do have in most colleges is a set of courses, is a mass of courses.
You call it a cafeteria?
Well, yeah, and that's a term that's been widely used, the cafeteria counter-curriculum. Now, this is not always bad. The courses are frequently good, but it seems to me that a curriculum means something more than just a bunch of more or less good courses thrown together. A curriculum implies an integration and connection.
Are there schools, for example, you're at the University of Chicago, are there schools and colleges around the country where the educational enterprise is working, in contrast to all of these terrible headlines that we read about how it's all falling apart?
There is a kind of grassroots movement toward curricular integration. We haven't heard much about it. I think one effect of the very violence and noise of this so-called culture war has tended to obscure some of the very interesting experiments that are taking place, often in small non-stream colleges or places like Evergreen State University in the Pacific Northwest, and places like the University of Missouri at Kansas City, who are working out ways to create really integrated curricula, integrate social science and humanities, integrate history and literature and philosophy and business. For that matter, these subjects have always had a lot to say to one another, and yet the structure of isolated courses and departments has tended to block that integration. And this, to me, is perhaps the most encouraging thing that's been going on in educational reform. There's a tremendous amount of a very interesting kind of reform going on in the direction of so-called learning communities.
Now, you use the word business. Let's shift that to another context, Gerald Graft. Should our universities be run like corporations? A lot of people say that that's basically what they are these days.
Well, universities are, of course. They are dependent. It seems to me a mistake not to confront the fact that universities have to worry about the budget.
Mm-hmm. And yet you say that they have a contradictory nature and direction. They want to pass on the inherited, our cultural inheritance, and yet they've got to struggle with new forms of knowledge.
Yeah.
That's not the kind of thing that a business person is likely to put up with, all of that conflict inside the arena.
No. But it seems to me one way in which education differs from business is that crisis and conflict in education can be quite productive and can be part, because they're part of the subject matter of education. One can study the crisis, one can analyze the conflict, one can help students deal with conflict situations, which is something that students are going to need to deal with in their lives.
Well, let me stop you for a moment. What is to prevent a situation like that from dwindling into what, a sort of a strategic, just studying the strategy of my camp versus your camp, rather than getting at what universities and professors used to call the truth in education?
Well, in my view, you get at the truth, and this is a very traditional view, you get at the truth by learning how to participate in the conflict. You know, you can go back to the Socratic dialogues, in a way, are based on the idea that you arrive at truth by struggling through the conflicts, or liberal thinkers like John Stuart Mill, who said that the truth ideally arises out of the marketplace of conflicting views. So I don't think there's any contradiction between teaching the conflicts and the assumption that the goal of education is to arrive at some truth. At the same time, I think we have to recognize that it's very likely that we're going to disagree about the truth and may not eventually end up arriving at the same conclusions. But I don't think that we ought to allow ourselves to be paralyzed because we disagree. And that, to me, is the unfortunate thing about the way a lot of people seem to be thinking about the culture war, both on the left and the right. That is, the assumption seems to be, if we can't agree on which story of Columbus is the right one, then we're lost. We can't educate successfully. And I think that's nonsense. People have disagreed about issues like this for centuries. The disagreements themselves are a big part of the vitality of education. Ideally, going through these disagreements will lead us to some agreement, some truth, but if it doesn't, there's no reason why the educational system has to collapse or be paralyzed.
Gerald Graff, give me a sense of this wonderful term, political correctness, as this plays into the culture wars.
Well, to some extent, I think that the critics of political correctness are, it's a case of the pot calling the kettle red. politics and strong, sometimes dogmatic and rigid political attitudes have played a role in education right from the beginning. So to single out people on the left side of the spectrum as uniquely authoritarian or totalitarian or something like that seems to me a gross exaggeration. There is political correctness. I don't want to deny it or minimize it. But I think it's a symptom, again, of the larger problem that I've been trying to talk about here before, that in universities we simply don't have healthy, productive ways of negotiating conflicts and disagreements.
So that's why they exist, don't they?
Yeah. Well, they should exist for that. Yeah. Universities, it seems to me, should be centers for discussing these issues, debating them, and working out ways of respecting one another's positions. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me, since we don't do that, since we faculty are largely isolated from one another or protected from one another, when conflicts do arise, they tend to get very ugly very fast and generate a lot of hatred and name-calling, and political correctness is, of course, one of the bad names that you use when you want to put down, you know, a colleague, sometimes rightly, but often that sort of name-calling doesn't lead anywhere.
Well, Jerry Graff, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are the George Pullman Professor of English and Education at the University of Chicago. Your books include Literature Against Itself and Professing Literature. This new book is called Beyond the Culture Wars, How Teaching the Conflicts Can Revitalize American Education. Available from Norton. Jerry, it's good to have you at the National Humanities Center. Good luck in your work.
Thank you very much for having me.
Cultural Conflict and American Education, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Up next, a conversation with David Bromwich of Yale University. We'll talk about his new book, Politics by Other Means.
I think there's a broad consensus now in the academic humanities and social sciences that, at the very least, that idea that thinking is done by one person is under challenge. The very idea of a person and what he or she is worth, the idea of a self and what the self is worth, is under challenge in the same way. A lot more credence is given to groups, whether anthropologically construed or socially or religiously or ethnically or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They seem more real.
David Bromwich is a professor of English at Yale University. His new book is Politics by Other Means, subtitled Higher Education and Group Thinking. The title of the book comes from the Prussian military officer Karl von Clausewitz, who said, "War is the continuation of politics by other means." According to David Bromwich, that description is a good analogy of what's going on in contemporary education, with the result that in many universities, intellectual inquiry takes the form of political passion and pressure. In his new book, David Bromwich argues that one key to understanding the dilemmas of education is the recognition of group thinking on many campuses. I asked him for a specific example.
If I'm studying a person, I might want to study, say, the writings of John Milton, and I would be studying them with large and particular emphasis on the continuity of his thoughts, perhaps the breaks in his thought, the kind of pressures, both social and personal, that he responded to. But a great deal of sharply driven attention would go to understanding him as the old way of saying it used to be, in his own terms. Mm-hmm. if I become convinced that there is an abstract entity called the discourse of empire or colonial discourse, which John Milton, as a secretary of Cromwell, is already participating in, then I'm going to study Milton alongside lots of other writers, many of them perhaps inferior as writers, but just as expressive, or thereby even more expressive of the kind of discourse he's participating in. The aim in this would be to get a sharper focus, again, a tighter hold on the kind of motives that incite people to their actions in writing or in life. The loss, I suppose, is that one has a less firm sense of who Milton was and what it might have been like to know his mind from inside.
Now, again, your book is called Politics by Other Means. You're looking at these academic wars that are going on in our universities. You use a couple of interesting terms, the culture of assent and the culture of suspicion. Give me a sense of those quickly, please.
Well, the book divides into at least two polemical parts, both attacking different tendencies that I don't care for. One is the right-wing group of ideologues. I specify two who worked in the mid-80s on educational projects, George Will and William Bennett, who were interested in promoting a standard Western-centered curriculum of great books. And both of those writers, Bennett and Will, are quite specific in declaring that they think reading these books will help students to understand what the West as a political entity is good for, and will help them be better, as it were, warriors for the West. It will contribute to the defense of the West. That's a phrase that at least one of them uses. The culture of assent is what I call that tendency, because it seems to me saying to American students, you're here reading books in order to discover everything that's right about your culture, and that's a foregone conclusion about the process of education. The culture of suspicion is almost non-existent in the mass media and in the broad political culture we think of as American culture, but it is it's the dominant note of American higher educational culture in the humanities and social sciences. And it is, if you want, the same culture-centered view of education, but with a minus sign in front of it. That is, it says it says Western books, Western things, the whole way of thinking, feeling, doing that we come into almost as a matter of habit if we're born in the commercial democracies, that these things are probably the masks for one kind of oppression or another. What the alternatives are or have been in the world, this way of thinking doesn't talk about, maybe programmatically doesn't talk about. But the division really is between a right-wing culture outside the academy and a left-wing culture inside it.
Now, one of your assumptions, help me with the phrasing here, David Bromwich, is that we really don't know how culture drives our motives and our actions. We haven't yet, as sophisticated as we are in our educational enterprise, we haven't figured out really the wellsprings of human motivation when we speak of that which is cultural. Unravel that for me.
I think that's true. I think culture is the generalized abstraction binding together numbers of human beings in their motives that has most appeal for educated people now, and not just educated people. It's what Kenneth Burke called a God term, and I've read sentences, quite a great many sentences in academic publications recently, where the kind of omnipotence and penetrative, pervasive power, it governs your every step, every breath you take, you know, and so on. Right. The kind of power that is ascribed to culture fits at every point the kind of power that would have been ascribed by an 18th century thinker about design to God, or by a 19th century transcendentalist to nature. We've got culture.
And what do? You attack this on the surface. I mean, it strikes me as a, regardless of your politics, quite an arrogant assumption. What do you do with that?
Well, the assumption about culture, I think of as not, it's arrogant, and at the same time, it's an expression of a certain discouragement over personal agency and the possibilities of thought that exist in the world, such mm-hmm. as they are. I'm trying to defend with what credibility is still left for it, the idea of thought as something that is not solely personal, but personal too, and to suggest that education in the humanities may be losing sight of this and that it's something we ought to keep inside. It's something that certainly was very much part of my education and that I'm grateful for.
Mm-hmm. Now, you teach at Yale University. You speak, as it were, from somewhat rather, I'm not sure what word to use here, but a rather privileged position here.
I think you can say that.
You have bright students. You teach at one of the nation's big research schools. Regardless of whether we're talking about the Ivy League schools or, you know, the so-called smaller schools, how are American undergraduates reacting to this whole question of the culture wars? At one level, my sense is that a lot of them don't care about this stuff. This is what, you know, goes on at cocktail parties for their professors, and the students get left out of the mix.
I agree. Students take the classes and go home and worry about what kind of jobs they might get after they graduate. So, I mean, from that side, it seems to me the responsibility is still with us to see that the kind of things we make them do with their time are the things that we feel are best worth spending time on in the long run. It's not quite true that none of the students have caught a glimpse of this. In conversations, and I talk about this in a footnote of the book, I've had the sense from between one and two dozen students over the past few years that certain unspoken limits on, you know, what they feel is allowed to be said in class are felt by them and felt as an inhibition. But they often say that this is truer with younger teachers, and they often, even oftener, say that the restrictions are most of all enforced tacitly by undergraduates themselves. One thing I try to get at in the book is the sense that there's no habits of political discussion and political controversy mm-hmm. that either our students or our colleagues are these days familiar enough with, and what's replaced it is this inculcation of a sort of foregone political consensus.
Now, what is the moral mission of the university, David Bromwich? Again, you teach at Yale, you run a humanities center up there. Let me become personal. What is your personal responsibility and stake as you meet these young and tender minds?
It's a very hard question. I think that the university shouldn't see itself as having one mission, as wanting to produce a certain kind of person or a certain kind of citizen. It's thinking on those lines, you know, we must create good citizens. That's been the problem both in the culture of assent, that is the right-wing culture outside the universities, and in the culture of suspicion inside. William James, when he was asked this question, said he had to think about it a long time, but the best answer he could come up with was, an education should teach you what a good man is like, to know a good man when you see one, and he implied man or woman, and that this was quite a hard work, and it might last you all the way through college to get to that point. If you think of it that way, and I think it's a good answer, well, what are the constituents that go into that kind of knowledge? Some of it is knowledge of human nature and human character and human personality. It certainly is knowledge of the individualities that people express in their daily lives, for good and for ill. It's also knowledge of the social constraints people operate under, the constraints that make them partly the creatures of their environment and that render them in part helpless. So that, I mean, some of the tendencies I'm trying to weigh in against in the book have their hand on part of the truth. We are social creatures. Never forget that. I had assumed always that it was the mission of the social sciences, especially, to stress that part of the truth. And perhaps, this is something I've come to feel more recently, perhaps it is correspondingly a little bit the mission of the humanities to stress the personal and individual part of the truth.
David Bromwich, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Give me a brief answer again to a large question. What do you say to the parents of your students? How do they figure in this equation? Do they get lost in the mix, as it were?
Well, if I were a parent hearing from my child in college, you know, complaints about the difficulties of saying what one wants to say because of unspoken restrictions in the classroom, I'd get worried and I'd try to participate and I'd get involved in the college in the dialogue about education. But I think that we have to realize at the same time, education is a breakaway move by students in relation to their parents. Parents, too, are one more institution that can, and often are, and almost always are, a force for repression against the impulses of people who are just learning who they want to be. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, higher education has a tense relationship, very naturally, with what parents want their kids to come out as.
Indeed. David Brumwich, I want to thank you for your overview of your book, your contribution to Soundings here. You are a professor of English at Yale and the director of the Whitney Humanities Program at Yale University. Let me mention your book. It is Politics by Other Means. The subtitle is Higher Education and Group Thinking. David, thank you for coming by to talk on Soundings. Good luck in your work.
Well, thank you.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guests were Gerald Graff of the University of Chicago and David Brumwich of Yale University. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Please ask for program number 654. That's number 654, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week, cinematic history and family pictures. Temma Kaplan of the State University of New York will be here to talk about her new book, Red City, Blue Period. Marianne Hirsch of Dartmouth College will also be here to talk about families and photography. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. American Education and the Culture Wars, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for conversations with Gerald Graff of the University of Chicago and David Brumwich of Yale University. Gerald Graff will be here to talk about his new book, Beyond the Culture Wars. David Brumwich will also be on hand to discuss his new book, Politics by Other Means. American Education and the Culture Wars. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.